"By the way," Gamini added as they turned to go, "don't worry about the check. It all goes on my father's tab. Come on, sweets." And as he and Maggie threaded their way between tables to the door, Ranjit understood what the plural pronoun had implied. And there Ranjit was, just him, and the girl named Prue. He lacked experience to tell him what was expected of him under these circumstances. He had, however, seen enough American films to get a clue. "Would you like another drink?" he said politely. She shook her head, grinning. She nodded at the nearly full glass in front of her. "I've barely wounded the last one. Anyway, I think another drink would be pretty superfluous, don't you?" He did, but he was running out of ideas for the next step. In the films, at this point, the man might ask the woman if she would care to dance. That wasn't an option here. No dancing was going on in this hotel bar, and anyway, Ranjit didn't know how. Prue saved him. "It's been a very nice evening, Ranjit Subramanian," she told him. "But I want to get up and do some sightseeing tomorrow. Do you think the waiter can get me a taxi?" Ranjit was surprised. "You aren't in this hotel?" "Booked the accommodation before we left London, and we took what they gave us. It's only about a 5-minute ride away." At that point, Ranjit knew what to do, and did. Prue was glad to be given a ride in the temple's van, even if Ranjit was a little drunk behind the wheel, and she was interested to hear about Ranjit's father's position in the temple, along with a sketchy outline of the long and colorful history of Tirukoneswaram. Enough so that she invited him in to sober up with a cup of coffee when they got to her hotel. The travel agency in London had given the girls a young people's hotel, with a lot of young people making the lobby a bit too noisy for a conversation, so Prue invited Ranjit up to her room. They talked, sitting companionably close, and propinquity worked its magic. Within an hour, Ranjit had lost his virginity, or at least his cross-gender virginity. He enjoyed it very much. So did Prue. Enough so that they did it twice more before they finally got to sleep. The sun was high and hot when the sound of a key in the lock woke them. It was Maggie, and she did not seem surprised to find both Ranjit and Prue in one of the room's twin beds. Gamini? Oh, he was long gone, had jumped out of bed and into his clothes when reception called to say that his father was waiting for him in the lobby. "And anyway," Maggie said, giving Prue an inquiring look, "we're supposed to be taken to lunch by your life-drawing instructor's cousin at the embassy, and it's 10:15. Ranjit, who was getting into his clothes as fast as he could, took that for an exit cue. What he wasn't sure of was how to take leave of Prue, and this time she was not helpful. She did give him a hearty goodbye kiss, but when he tentatively suggested that if they wanted sightseeing he was available, she couldn't see a way of fitting him into their other obligations that day, or any other day, for that matter. Ranjit got the message. He kissed her again, with the intensity dimmed down much lower this time, waved a farewell to Maggie, and left. Back in the van, he considered. He had the van and his own freedom for at least a week. But there was nothing to keep him in Colombo, and nothing to attract him to any other part of Sri Lanka. So he shrugged and started the engine, and began the long drive back to Trinco. An hour later he was outside of the Colombo city limits, and wondering what his father would say when he returned the van so early. Most of his wondering, though, was devoted to the subject of Ms. Prue never did know her last name. Why had she behaved in the way— no, in the several contradictorily different ways that she had in their short but, at least for Ranjit, highly significant relationship? He was nearly 30 kilometers down the road before he came to a satisfactory answer. Well, satisfactory wasn't the best word to use. He was fairly sure he had the explanation, but he didn't like it at all. His conclusion was that Prue's actions were a function of his skin color. Having sex with a short and dark-skinned Asian man, what was the name people in Prue's social class used for that sort of person? Oh, yes, Wog, for wily Oriental gentlemen. Having sex with such a man might be an enjoyable experiment when no one knew about it except another young woman engaged in doing the same thing. But it was not acceptable where one might be seen by people who might speak of it to people in London or to people in Shaker Heights, whatever Shaker Heights might happen to be. So for the next hour or so, Ranjit's thoughts were glum. They didn't stay that way, though. Whatever thoughts might have been in Prue's mind, the things her body had been doing while she was thinking them were quite pleasing for him to remember. It had been, Ranjit admitted to himself, one of the most intensely pleasurable experiences of his life. All right, it appeared that it was to be a one-time-only event with that particular partner, but there were other women in the world, were there not? Including some who were not concerned about the color of his skin? Including, for instance, Myra de Souza? That was an interesting new thought for Ranjit. Experimentally, he set his imagination a new task, which was to replay his memories of the night in bed with Prue something, but replace Prue in the role of female partner with Myra herself. Ranjit had not previously been thinking of Myra in that way exactly, but he discovered that it wasn't hard to do. It was pretty enjoyable, too, until, unfortunately, the thought of the Canadian hotel man, Brian Harrigan, began to come up in his mind. That part wasn't pleasant at all. Reluctantly, Ranjit gave up that experiment, and doing his best not to think of anything at all, simply drove on. The sun was nearly setting by the time he at last got to Trincomalee. Ranjit thought about going back to his lonely room, but what he wanted was someone to talk to about, well, not about Prue Last Nameless, of course, but anyway, just to talk. He took a chance on driving to the Kanakaratnam house, and won. They were all inside. Though the door was closed, he could hear Dot Kanakaratnam's voice, but no one else's. When Tiffany answered his knock and let him in, he saw that her mother was sitting at the table and talking into a cell phone. Ranjit hadn't known she owned one. When she saw him in the doorway, she said a few quick words into the phone and folded it shut. There was something in the look on her face that troubled Ranjit. Anger? Sadness? He couldn't tell. What she said was, "You're early, Ranjit. We thought you'd be spending more time with your friend." "So did I," he said, a tad ruefully. "But it didn't work out. I had a good time, though." He had not been intending to tell them exactly how good, more about what an interesting place Colombo was, but the expressions on the faces of the children stopped him. "Is something wrong?" he asked. Dot answered for the whole family. "It's George, my husband. He's escaped." That was news that trumped anything Ranjit might have said. He pressed for details. George Kanakaratnam, for some inscrutable police reason, had been in the process of being transferred from one prison to another. There had been a car crash. The guard and the driver had been killed. Kanakaratnam had not, and he had simply walked away. "The Trinco police were here all day," Harold volunteered when his mother paused to breathe. "They said Da might have got away on a boat. There was a bridge that went over a pretty big river right down the road." "But there wasn't any blood there," Rosie said triumphantly, puzzling Ranjit. It seemed to him that with two dead, there had to be some spilled blood somewhere around the scene. Tiffany clarified the matter. "She means there wasn't any blood inside the bus, except for right around the front seats, so our father probably didn't get hurt." Dot met Ranjit's look with a hostile look of her own. "You're thinking of George as a jailbird, but to them he's their father." "Naturally they love him," she informed Ranjit. Then, in a friendly tone, "Can I give you a cup of tea? And we'd like to hear all about your trip." Obeying her gesture, Ranjit sat at the table. He didn't get a chance to tell them his story, though, because Tiffany was waving her hand. When the girl spoke, it wasn't to Ranjit, but to her mother. "Is this when we should tell him about the letter?" she asked. Dot gave Ranjit a stricken look. "Oh, I'm sorry. There was so much going on here that I just forgot." She scrabbled in the litter of papers on the table for a moment, then pulled out an envelope and handed it to Ranjit. "One of the monks brought it. It's been sitting in the temple mail room for a week because nobody told them where you were staying. And then this morning, when they figured it out, they tried to deliver it to your room, but you weren't there," Tiffany put in. "And our mother told them they could leave it here and we'd see that you got it."
Dot looked embarrassed.
"I did, yes. The police were here, and I just wanted everybody to go away."
She stopped when she realized Ranjit was no longer listening to her. The envelope had the return address of the beach hotel nearest the construction site. So did the sheet of notepaper inside, and what it said was, "Dear Ranjit, I'll be here for a few days. Is there any chance we could get together for a cup of tea or something of the sort?" It was signed Myra de Souza. Ranjit didn't wait for the tea with the Kanakaratnams. "I'll see you later," he said, already on his way out the door. Driving to the hotel didn't take longer than 20 minutes. The young woman at the desk was as helpful as she could be, but when it came down to it, all she could tell him was, "Oh, but they checked out yesterday, Ms. de Souza and Mr. Harrigan. I think they may have gone back to Colombo." Back in the van, Ranjit allowed himself to admit how much he regretted having missed her, and how much he disliked the fact that she and the Canadian were traveling together. His mood depressed, he drove slowly back. At the turn that would have taken him to the Kanakaratnam house, he paused, then turned the other way. It was interesting, in a way, that Dot's husband had managed to escape from a federal prison. Ranjit had looked forward to telling the children about his trip, too. Well, about parts of it. But not right now. Right now he didn't want to talk to anybody about anything. The next day he went back to his job. The foreman's brother-in-law was not at all happy to see him, but when Ranjit picked up the Kanakaratnam children, they were happy enough that it made up for it. When it became story time, they loved hearing about how the kings of Kandy had fought off the European invaders for so many years, as Ranjit had read off his computer first thing that morning, and did not seem to want to talk about their escapee father. Neither did their mother, not for several days at least, and then when he stopped off for the kids one morning, he didn't get them. Dot Kanakaratnam was seated at the table, putting clothes and household goods into sacks, and all four of the children were packing little bundles of their own. When she saw the question in Ranjit's eyes, she gave him a great smile. "I have wonderful news, Ranjit. Some old friends have found me a job. It's right here in Trinco, too, although down by the port. I'm not sure what the work is exactly, but they say it will pay well, and an apartment of our own comes with it." She gave Ranjit an expectant look. "That's wonderful," he said, doing his best to supply what she wanted. He found himself wondering how she couldn't know what job she was taking, but he realized she was desperate, so he didn't pursue it. "When would you start?" "Almost immediately. There is one thing, though, Ranjit. You still have your father's van, don't you? And taxis are so expensive. Could you give us a lift to the port?" Chapter 10. A New Life for the Kanakaratnams. He did have the van, because his father had told him to keep it for commuting to work, so he could drive them. At least he could, as soon as he had notified the foreman that his brother-in-law could have his payday a little longer. By the time he got back to Dot's house, everything was ready. 20 minutes later, he had the children squealing with excitement in the back of the van, while Dot sat beside him studying the harbor as they approached. The port was not a sight Ranjit had seen much of since Sri Lanka had attained peace. True, there were reminders of the unruly outside world. On the far side of the harbor he could make out the shark shapes of a couple of nuclear submarines, probably Indian, and so much else. There were fishing vessels, of course, and not of the 4 or 5 mankind that were pulled up on every beach around the island. These were the deep-water craft that would sail 100 kilometers or more from land for the commercially valuable schools. There were freighters of all kinds and sizes, being relieved of their containers or bulk cargoes or having new ones loaded, and Ranjit saw with astonishment that there were several ships of a different kind entirely, painted brilliant white, festooned with lifeboats hanging in their davits, lined with rows of portholes. Why, the cruise ships were back. Ranjit couldn't help pulling over to let the children get a look. He expected childish whoops of excitement and was puzzled when what he got instead was the children's endless whispering in each other's ears. Dot, however, was having no delays. "Settle down," she ordered the children. Then to Ranjit, "I'd like to get there as soon as I can. Do you see the souvenir shop next to where those white ships are docked? I think that's the place." It was a fairly shabby little kiosk, not particularly busy either. A few elderly tourists in bright-colored shorts and imitation Hawaiian shirts were desultorily studying its picture postcards and plastic elephant figurines. But it was where Dot Kanakaratnam insisted on going, children and all. She reassured him, "Yes, this is the place. Our friends will come for us, and now, Ranjit, you must go." And she added, suddenly flinging her arms around him, "The children will miss you, and so will I." One after another, the children gave him their own hugs. And as Ranjit drove away, he could see that they were all crying. Of course, Ranjit didn't cry. He was a grown man. Anyway, people were looking at him. Ranjit was in no hurry to get back to his job on the beach, no longer with any small children there to amuse him. Four or five little restaurants and snack shops were nearby, ready for the custom of the cruise ship passengers. He parked near the least unattractive of them for a cup of tea and sat for a time musing over how rapidly little children could win over a heart. It was odd, he thought, that Dot should know details such as, for instance, that she was going to get an apartment with the job, but not seem to know what the job itself was going to be. It almost made Ranjit wonder if Dot was being less than truthful with him. But that was a thought easy to dismiss. What reason could the woman have to keep secrets from him? When he left the shop, he cast a quick glance at where he had left them. They were gone. Ranjit wished them a silent goodbye and good luck, and drove unhurriedly along the bay front. He passed a sweet-smelling little freighter being loaded with cinnamon for export, next to a container ship from Singapore now unloading, it was safe to assume, cars, computers, and domestic appliances from the factories of China. Next was the cluster of cruise ships, a good deal more bedraggled at close range than they had first seemed. A few passengers who apparently had no interest in the ground tours to Swami Rock or his father's temple lounged around the railings of the upper decks. One was a little girl who was waving joyously in his direction. No! It wasn't just any little girl, it was tiny Betsy Kanakaratnam, and running rapidly toward her, apparently with the intention to scold her, was her big sister Tiffany. And a few meters away was the one boy in the family holding the hand of a squat, dark man. Could that be Kirthis Kanakaratnam? It could hardly be anyone else. Tiffany was already calling to the man, dragging her baby sister toward him. The man nodded consideringly. Then he turned toward Ranjit, who was leaning out of the van window below. Grinning broadly, the man gestured to him. What he was trying to say was not hard to understand. He was waving Ranjit to come aboard the ship, pointing to a parking space not far away, pointing to himself and then to the gangway that linked the ship to the dock. Ranjit didn't hesitate. He turned toward the indicated parking space, shut off the engine, slammed the van door, and trotted up the gangway. As he climbed, he saw that this ship was clearly not one of the 50,000-ton behemoths that cruised the Caribbean and the Greek islands. It was a lot smaller, a lot dirtier, and had a lot more places in its paint job where chipping indicated the need for a new coat. At the head of the gangway, a large black-bearded man in a white ship's uniform stood before a badge reader and a little gate. Next to him, however, stood the presumed George Kanakaratnam, who said something in the man's ear and then spoke welcomingly to Ranjit. "Come aboard, come aboard. It's grand to meet you, Mr. Subramanian. The kids have had so much to say about you. Now, this way, please. We'll go down and have a word with Dot, and you can see what a nice stateroom the children have, all their own.
and I'm getting good pay, and it looks like they'll find a job for Dot, too. It's just the luckiest break we ever had."
"Well," Ranjit said, "I guess you were pretty lucky. Kanakaratnam wasn't slowing down for interruptions, especially ambiguous ones that could refer to a jailbreak."
"You bet," he said. "Good pay, too. Now we just go down these steps."
They did, and walked through another passage and down more steps, with Kirthis, or George, Kanakaratnam, never stopping his recital of how lucky his family was and how fond his children were of Ranjit Subramanian. They passed through 7 or 8 doors, all of the kind that would spring irrevocably closed in an emergency, and most marked "no admittance," until at last they came to a door of a quite different kind, a kind that Kanakaratnam stopped before and knocked on. It was opened by a large, bearded man.
"He's Somalian," Kanakaratnam told Ranjit. "They all look like that, pretty much."
And he gave the bearded man a nod, and the man nodded back. Then, in a quite different tone, Kanakaratnam said, "Now sit down. You're going to have to stay here for a day or two. You don't want to make any loud noises or try to leave, because if you do, he'll kill you." He gestured at the Somalian. Evidently the man understood enough of what was going on, because he patted a wide-bladed kind of knife that he carried thrust into his belt. "Have you got all that?" Kanakaratnam asked. "No noise. Don't try to leave. You stay here until somebody tells you it's all right to leave. So don't make trouble, and you'll turn out to have an interesting trip after we take over the ship."
Chapter 11 Pirate Life.
It was a little longer than Kanakaratnam had suggested before Ranjit was freed. It took long enough anyway for him to be fed several times, quite well, actually, because the kitchen was, after all, on a cruise ship. At least twice Ranjit fell restlessly asleep on the hard cot that stood against the wall. The Somalian left him alone several times, but not without locking the door behind him. Ranjit thought it over carefully before taking the risk of trying it. It was thoroughly locked. Kanakaratnam looked in a couple of times, apparently just to be sociable. He was quite willing to explain to Ranjit what was going on. On the second day, the pirates, that was the word Kanakaratnam himself used, pirates, stormed the bridge, disarmed those of the crew who were not actually already colleagues, and announced that the ship was changing course for the port of Busasso in, yes, Somalia. Before Ranjit was released, the pirates looted everything of value from the ship's strongroom and everything easily portable from the staterooms of the passengers, who, they were informed, would fairly soon be on their way home, unharmed, provided only that their families or friends came up with the appropriate ransom money. "You would be surprised," Kanakaratnam told Ranjit, "what some people will pay to get Grandma back." And then there was the ship itself. If they got it safely to the right port in Somalia, a paint job and some decent false papers could make it the most saleable item of all. It was all very businesslike. It was, in fact, Kanakaratnam explained, pretty much like any other commercial enterprise. Since the beginnings of the 21st century, piracy had become a fairly big business on its own, with established brokerage houses prepared to collect a ransom and pass it on to those demanding it, in return for which they guaranteed the safe return of the captives. "In fact," Kanakaratnam told Ranjit with satisfaction, "getting caught with that stolen junk was the luckiest thing that ever happened to me. My cellmate at Batikaloa was supposed to be in on this, but he got picked up for something else. But he told me all about it, and when I got a chance to get away, I knew just where to go." Even businesslike piracy did, of course, sometimes have its unpleasant side. One bad side, Ranjit was pretty sure, was what the pirates did with any crew members who resisted them too vigorously. Ranjit asked Kanakaratnam, but he simply didn't answer, which was answer enough for Ranjit. When Kanakaratnam told Ranjit that the takeover was complete and he could come out of his cell, Ranjit found out there had been at least one unsavory occurrence. It was because of the ship's captain, who had possessed an excessive sense of duty. He hadn't wanted to turn over the keys to the strongroom. Of course, that problem had been readily solved. The pirates had shot the captain on the shuffleboard court and promoted the much more cooperative first officer, who himself had pulled the keys out of the deceased man's pocket and handed them over. Ranjit had never been on a cruise ship before. Despite the grim circumstances, this one still offered all sorts of absurd amenities. There was a swimming pool on the top deck, though not conveniently usable when there was any significant wave action, which was almost always. The kitchen produced quite good meals, even if the actual passengers were clumped despondently together on one side of the dining room, watched over by pirates with assault rifles. The casino was closed, but that made little difference since all the passengers had already been relieved of the cash and credit cards they might have gambled with. The bars were closed, too, and there was no nightly show in the barroom theater. But there were canned movies on the TV screens in every stateroom, and the weather was balmy. Too balmy, according to Kanakaratnam. "I'd rather have more clouds," he said. "You don't know how many eyes are up there watching us. Satellites," he clarified, when Ranjit looked puzzled. "Of course they don't pay much attention to an old rust bucket like this, but you never know." "Oh," he added, reminding himself of an obligation, "and Tiffany's looking for you. Wants to know if you'll help her with the kids up on the sun deck." "Why not?" Ranjit said agreeably, in fact rather looking forward to seeing his four playmates again. He was miserable, yes, but doing everything he could to hide it. When he came out of the stairwell into the bright, tropical daylight of the sun deck, he couldn't help casting a quick look at the sky. Of course, he couldn't see any of those eyes in the sky. He hadn't expected to, but could not help wondering just who it might be whose eyes were staring down at them at that moment. And, of course, he had no idea of what totally non-human eyes some of them were. There turned out to be about 20 children among the ship's passengers, ranging from 6 or 7 up to about 14. Most of them spoke reasonable approximations of English, and what Tiffany wanted Ranjit to do, of course, was tell them stories so that they would forget having seen the murdered captain's body exposed all day near the shuffleboard courts. That turned out to be a tall order. 2 of the 10-year-olds never stopped crying, and several of the others could not seem to take their eyes off the rifle-carrying pirate who patrolled the deck. It may have been that Ranjit made it even harder on himself, because rather than doing the simple and never-failing Russian multiplication thing again, he decided to show the children how to count on their fingers, binary style. It was not a success. Clearly, none of the passenger children had ever heard of binary numbers before. When Ranjit informed them that if you wanted to say you had 1 of something in binary, you could just write the old familiar 1, but if you had 2, you had to write it as 10 and 3 as 11, the incomprehension was palpable. He pressed on, gamely. "Now we come to the counting on your fingers part," he told them, holding up his 2 hands. "What you have to do now is assume that every one of your fingers represents a numeral, and yes, Tiffany, I know what you're going to ask. Yes, we do count the thumb as a finger." Tiffany hadn't said anything, but cheerfully nodded. "Each numeral has to be a 1 or a 0, because that's all you have to work with in binary arithmetic. When the fingers are retracted," he made 2 fists, "each finger is a 0. So now look here." He laid his 2 fists on the tabletop before him. "In binary, these 10 retracted fingers represent the number 0000000000, which is just another way of saying that 0 is the number all 10 of the zeros represent, because no matter how many zeros you write down, it's still just 0. But now, look at this." He stuck out all the fingers on both hands. "Now they're all 1s, and the binary number I'm displaying is 1111111111. And that means, if you want to express it in the decimal equivalent, that you're writing a 1 for the last numeral 1 in the line, plus a 2 for the numeral 1 next to it, plus a 4 for the 1 next to that, doubling each time, you see, all the way up to 512 for the last numeral 1 at the end of the left hand. And so you have written..." He did the arithmetic with a crayon on a scrap of paper. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512. And if you add them all up together, you get 1,023. And so you've counted on your fingers all the way up to 1,023.
Ranjit paused to look around at his audience. What he got back was not what he had hoped for. The number of weepers had risen to 4 or 5, and the expressions on the other faces ranged from simple confusion to resentful bafflement. Then, tardily, questions did begin.
Do you mean... Wait a minute, Ranjit, are you trying to say...
And finally, rewardingly.
Oh, let's see if I got it right. Let's say we're counting fish. So what that numeral 1 at the right-hand edge means is that there's one pile of fish that has only one fish in it, and the numeral 1 next to it means there's another pile that has 2 fish, and piles with 4 fish and 8 fish all the way up to the pile... That's the numeral 1 at the other end that has 512 fish in it. And you add all the piles together, and altogether you've got 1,023 fish. Is that it?
It is, Ranjit said, gratified in spite of himself. Gratified despite the fact that the only children who had responded at all were Dot and Kirthis Kanakaratnam's kids, and the one who had really understood was, of course, Tiffany. Kanakaratnam himself didn't seem to worry about Ranjit's poor reception. When he joined Ranjit for lunch, 2 kinds of soup, 3 different salads, and at least 6 entrees on the menu, he said approvingly, "You did yourself some good today." He did not say in what way, though Ranjit, who had also caught a glimpse of the late captain's splayed and riddled corpse, had a pretty good idea of what it was. When Kanakaratnam returned an hour later, he made it explicit. "You need to keep on showing my friends that you're cooperating with us," he told Ranjit. "There's been questions. So look, here's the thing. We need to get biographical information about every passenger, to know how high to set the ransom, and most of our guys don't speak any language the passengers can understand. So you can help us out that way, right?"
There was a question in the tone of Kanakaratnam's voice, but in the realities of the situation Ranjit faced, there was none. It was clear to him that his best hope of survival was to be useful to the pirates, so he spent a few hours of each of the next 2 days questioning elderly couples, sometimes terrified, more often belligerent, about their bank accounts, pensions, real estate holdings, and possibly wealthy relatives. That lasted for only a couple of days, though. Just until the trouble struck. It was still dark when a change in the ship's noise level woke Ranjit. The comforting sound of the ship's engines was no longer the languid kaplum-kaplum, but had become a fast and frantic bega-bega-bega-bega. Even louder was the yelling back and forth that came from the passage outside his room. When he peered out, he saw members of the original crew trotting as fast as they could toward the exits. Each of the men was carrying 2 or 3 suitcases, obviously purloined from the passengers' staterooms, and, Ranjit was quite sure, stuffed full of passengers' stolen valuables. Most of the yelling came from one of the pirates, urging the crew members along with a rope's end. The pirates looked angry and worried. The captive crew members looked scared to death. Once again, it seemed to Ranjit that it would be a good idea to make himself useful. He backtracked the bag carriers to one of the ship's stairwells, where other crewmen were throwing stolen bags down to his level. As Ranjit was about to pick up a couple of the bags to carry, he heard a childish voice calling his name, and when he looked up, Dot Kanakaratnam and her brood were coming down the steps toward him. All of them, even the tiny Betsy, were carrying a share of the loot, and Tiffany was full of information. An hour or two earlier, one of the pirates had spotted what looked like ship's lights far astern.
"But nothing showed on the radar," Tiffany informed him excitedly. "So you know what that means?"
Ranjit didn't, but he was capable of a decent guess.
"A naval vessel with stealth anti-radar?" "Exactly. We're being followed by some destroyer or something. That means we can't make it to Somalia anymore, so we're going to have to beach this ship somewhere. I guess it'll be India or Pakistan, probably. And then just disappear into the woods. Up on the bridge, they're working the radio now, trying to arrange for one of the local gangs to help us.
And why would a local gang of crooks want to do that when they can just take the loot away from us? Ranjit asked.
But the children didn't even try to answer that, and Dot said only,
Come on, let's get some of this stuff down to the departure place.
Once everything worth stealing had been lugged to the B-deck exit, there was nothing useful for any of the pirates to do. They mostly wound up on one of the outside decks, worriedly scanning the horizon for some trace of their radar-blind pursuer, or even more worriedly studying the horizon ahead for a glimpse of where the ship would be run aground. There wasn't actually much to see but water. If there was another craft or point of land anywhere near them, it did not reveal itself to Ranjit. Around noon, he tired of the sport, went down to find something for lunch, and then returned to throw himself onto his bed. He was asleep in minutes. And then awakened again when a violent metallic screeching and a rocking and bouncing motion that almost threw him to the floor told Ranjit they had arrived. Then the ship was at rest, though tilted a half dozen degrees from the vertical. Ranjit looked around to make sure there was nothing for him to take. There wasn't. And then, clutching the safety rails, made his way to the exit port. Nearly all of the spoils were already off the ship and being licked by wavelets from the sea behind them. So were most of the people, pirates, passengers, and captive crew alike. Some of the pirates were quite ungently ordering the crew and the passengers to carry the wet suitcases above the high water mark. Ranjit cast one look around, found no human beings on the shore, and let himself down into the warm, calf-deep water. Humans had been on that shore at one time. They had left unmistakable signs of their presence. This was one of those deserted Indian Ocean beaches that once had been used for low cost and low safety, shipbreaking. The whole place stank of oil and rust. All up and down the edge of the water were fragments of old hulls or of discarded bits of ship's furnishings, chairs, beds, tables, too old and damaged to be worth removing. What was nowhere in sight, though Ranjit knew they had once been there, was any trace of the desperately poor men who had taken the jobs of cutting up the hulls and separating out the commercially profitable sections of engines and drive shafts, the men who had died on that beach, as often as not, from the toxic substances that would have made the job too expensive on any better policed stretch of coast. How much of those trapped poisons and carcinogens might remain in the sands and waters around him, Ranjit could not guess. The best way to deal with that problem, Ranjit knew, was to get off that beach as quickly as possible. There didn't seem to be any good way of doing that. If there was to be help from local gangs, Ranjit could see no signs of it. Well, there might have been something, a quick glimpse of some shadowy something half concealed by the brush, but when he looked again, nothing was there. Waiting just behind Ranjit, Dot Kanakaratnam was doing her best to keep hold of four little hands at once without letting go of her loot bags. Finally, she gave up and shoved one of the bags at Ranjit.
Here, she said, it's George's spare clothes. You hang on to them until he shows up. I want to get these kids out of the water.
She didn't wait for his consent. Kids attached, she shuffled through the hot sands to the high water mark where she stood and looked all around for her husband. Ranjit himself was suddenly the target of one of the pirates, waving his gun approximately at a cluster of the captive crew, but clearly shouting at Ranjit, who wasn't sure what the man was ordering, but thought it was not likely to be anything he wanted to do. So he bobbed his head as though in agreement, while turning and running as fast as he could around the stern of the beached ship. He didn't stop until he was out of sight of the pirate. That was when he heard the first, distant, mournful hooting. It was a scary sound, not musical exactly, but reminiscent of the background to a horror film as the undead begin to clamber out of their coffins. Nor was he the only one who heard it. Up on the beach, a pirate who had flung himself to the sand, panting with the exertion of getting there, sat up and looked wonderingly around.
So did another pirate, and a couple of the crew, all sitting or standing and trying to see where the sound had come from. Then Ranjit saw them, a string of distant aircraft coming toward them from the sea. Helicopters. At least a dozen of them, and every one fitted with curious soup plate-like discs, all rotating with every shift in the chopper's course to remain pointed at the people on the beach. And the sound grew louder, and kept on growing louder and louder.
For all the rest of his very long life, Ranjit Subramanian never managed to forget that day on the beach. True, there were even worse days that followed it, but those terrifying and degrading moments under the acoustic barrage from the helicopters were bad enough for anyone. Ranjit had never before been exposed to the sublethal armorarium of a modern assault force. He had not known what it would mean for the sound to bypass the brain. It was the belly that caught the worst of its effects, the bowels loosened, the vomiting profuse, the sick pain remorseless. Nor was the attack entirely sublethal. At least two of the pirates managed to fight back the miseries of their bodies long enough to fire a few rounds at the helicopters from their assault rifles. Unfortunately for Ranjit, this included Kirthis Kanakaratnam. That was a mistake. Each of the choppers contained two open doorways, one occupied by a machine gunner, the other by an equally death-dealing man with a grenade launcher, and neither pirate survived firing his weapon by more than a minute. And as to those other watchers from the skies, they found this incident puzzling, even the ones called the Nine Limbs. Oh, the Nine Limbs had seen human firefights before. The Nine Limbs were the only client race the Grand Galactics encouraged to be linguists, and their main mission was to tell their masters what these humans said to one another. But you couldn't spy on humans for very long without encountering violence. The Nine Limbs had thought they knew what was coming this time. When they had identified a surface craft abristle with chemical explosive weapons lurking in slow-motion pursuit of another that was apparently unarmed, they had supposed the outcome would be another human bloodbath. They had even wondered if it was worth their while to stick around to observe just one more example of human mass murder. It was a surprise to them that so few of the humans on the beach were put to death as a result of having their integuments penetrated by the projectile weapons from the aircraft. They recognized the nature of the chopper's primary weapons, the compression air device, the ring vortex cannon, and all the others, because they had seen their like before. After all, there were few weapons employed by the human race that had not been employed over and over by other races at other places and times in the galaxy.